This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to the Bike Radar Podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus, and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you.
We're talking all things gravel for our new seven-part podcast series here on Bike Radar, hosted by yours truly, Catherine Moore. From getting kitted out with the best gear for you to route planning, dipping your toes into gravel racing and simply why we love hitting the path less travelled, we've got a mega panel of special guests and in-house experts lined up for you. Welcome back for episode 3 of our gravelly series here on the Bike Radar podcast. Last week we looked at how to choose the best gravel bike for you, and this time we're taking a deeper dive into gravel bike setup. To help us navigate this topic, we're chatting to Veeran Gozzi Sambrook, an avid adventure cyclist who was thrown in at the deep end last year when she was awarded the 2021 Ultra Distance Scholarship and prepared to take on the 1600-mile Pan-Celtic race. We're also joined by Bike Radar's Felix Smith, a fellow long-distance cyclist and gravel enthusiast who does know a thing or two about bike setup. Felix has raced the supremely hilly Irish Ultra Route, the Transatlantic Way, as well as raced in Granduro and the Dirty Reaver here in the UK. Last, but by no means least, lifelong mountain biker turned gravel convert Tom Marvin is joining us. With nearly a decade of bike testing experience under his belt, Tom's take on gravel kit and setup options from a mountain biker's perspective is a really fascinating one. He's also just about to go and ride a chunk of the European Divide bikepacking route, so perhaps Tom will be taking notes from Vera and Felix here too. Welcome everyone to the Bike Radar podcast.
Hello, Catherine.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. So we've got a really nerdy one today, which I'm very excited about. We covered a very broad look at gravel bikes last week with choosing the gravel bike, but now it's really delving down into the details of specifically the bike setup for you and for the kind of events you want to be doing. So there's loads of different aspects of gravel bike setup to look at, whether it's gearing or braking choice, 650B wheels, 700 different tyres. But I think the fundamental is how you're seated on the bike and your bike position. So Tom, you've come from a mountain biking background into gravel riding. Has that changed your position on the bike significantly? How does it feel in comparison?
I'm not sure it has changed my particular position on a gravel bike. I'm a bit of a I like a racy gravel bike, much as I ride road bikes occasionally, and I like a very race focused road bike, and I think that's probably had more of an impact on my gravel bike setup. I guess partly because I'm more comfortable in a racy setup, but I like being in an aggressive position on a drop barred bike, and I think my mountain bike background maybe has helped me with the confidence aspect to be in that aggressive position on the bike. We chatted in episode 1 of the podcast about how if you're new to gravel, the feeling of your tires losing traction can be a little bit daunting for some people. But obviously, having mountain biked for 20 years, that for me is almost part of the fun. And so I think, you know, if we're talking about gravel as a whole, you have everything from super aggressive race bikes that maybe are a little bit more sketchy or a bit more twitchy, up to like really comfortable sit-up and cruisy bikes, which may be a little bit safer in terms of their geometry and handling. But personally, I've come from, you know, that mountain bike background where I'm quite happy with maybe a slightly more aggressive setup. So that's probably where I sort of sit on the setup side of things and on the shaping thing. I think one of the things I sort of had thought about when we were talking about this podcast was, in mountain biking, position on the bike isn't something that's discussed very much. You buy your bike and you might think about the reach and the seat tube length and the geometry from a handling perspective. But I think on the road side of things, there's a little bit more of a focus, or maybe there should be a bit more of a focus on the bike fit and how it fits your body shape and how flexible you are and what position you want to be in for how long. And I think from a gravel side of things, that's probably something that's a bit more worth considering.
That's really interesting to hear that. The mountain bike fit, because I ride different bikes. I've got the gravel bike, road bike, mountain bike, and I've had a bike fit for my sort of road bike and gravel bike position, but I've not had one for a mountain bike, and it's something I've been considering, but it's one of those things I think you don't hear talked of much in terms of, you know, mountain bike setup.
No, I think it's something that maybe should be talked about a little bit more, but it feels like I guess on a mountain bike you're often a little bit more mobile over the position of the bike. You're rarely sat in one position for an extended period of time where the fit comes in. So when you've had your road and gravel bike fits, have you had a different one, or has the person who's been doing the bike fit suggested different things for your gravel bike to your road bike? Or
no, it's much the same for me, really, because I go for endurance riding, so it transfers quite easily across because it's a more relaxed upright position. So all that's different really between my road bike and my gravel bike is I just change the wheels from my gravel bike to thinner ones, and everything else is pretty much the same.
Nice. Whereas I suppose that would be quite different if, for example, you had a very aggressive sort of cafe or club ride position on your road bike, you know, when you're only going out for a couple of hours, versus a gravel bike that's designed to tackle steep, rooty tech. It could be completely different, but that's fascinating, I guess, because you're coming at it from an endurance standpoint that you just need to be comfortable on those bikes for really long periods of time. How about you, Felix? Does that sort of apply to you, or do you vary your position quite greatly across different bikes?
Yeah, so I guess I've, you know, come from a similar position to Vera, really, being a bit more endurance focused. But I guess like last year, if I looked at what I chose to ride for Grinduro, which is definitely more of an aggressive kind of trail, like you know, you're going down some mountain bike trails, which are quite fun.
Oh yes.
compared to my bike setup for that event, compared to Dirty Reaver, which is a bit more of a it's a much longer event. I guess I didn't really do a huge amount different, but the main things were sort of that the height of the front end height, basically, to put it simply. For Dirty Reaver, I wanted something that was quite high, quite sort of more relaxed, because I didn't want to get halfway around and have backache, or I just wanted to do the distance and have a bit of fun. Whereas for Grinduro, there were a few kind of hill climb sections, as well as kind of mountain bike trails. So I had a bit more of a neutral kind of position for that. And I guess, there's loads of different setup things that you could go into, but overall kind of position wise, wasn't a great deal different between those two events, but some subtle changes with the height.
Definitely. I think the thing that I find most noticeable when I hop between my road bike and my gravel bike is simply the use of flared bars. And this is something that's really quite common across different gravel bikes. It could be the same position on the hoods or slightly flared at the tops, but then much more flared at the ends of the drops. Is this something that any of you use on your gravel bike setups?
My gravel bars are definitely, I think they've got about 16 degrees of flare. I like the way that is. I spend, you know, if you're riding sort of more technical descents off-road, I tend to drop down onto the drops to give sort of better hold on the brakes rather than sort of sitting on the hoods and feeling like I'm going to pop over the front. And I've often found when I've had like very little flare, you know, a couple of degrees or whatever, I find that the inside, because it's quite shallow drop as well, like the insides of my wrists sort of like catch on the radius of the tops. And I find that quite annoying, especially sort of if you're negotiating more technical terrain. So yeah, having a flared bar, I think really helps off-road. Well, yeah, with the technical stuff.
And another thing that I just thought of there, Tom, was when you are sort of breaking down a steeper descent on drop bars and you're in the drops, it's being able to grab the brake levers properly. I don't have the longest fingers in the world, and I think I'm not, by no means, they're not short. I think making sure that your levers are in the right position is pretty key.
Definitely, and that's something that costs absolutely nothing to change, and it, you know, could be a 5-10 minute job that could make just your general position and being able to reach and confidently, comfortably control the brakes much, much easier. I don't think you're able to adjust every single type of brake, but that's definitely one you can check in on, especially if you have slightly smaller hands like me. And another thing about the flared bars, while we're on the subject, and Vera will probably agree with me here, is that it just gives you so much more space for stuff up front. So like getting a wider handlebar roll. Is that something that you do, Vera?
So I actually haven't got flared bars. It's something I'd love to try. Ooh. But because my bike doubles a lot, as I'm just literally changing between 28 mil wide tyres and 45 gravel and road, I've just got the sort of standard handlebars even when I'm off-road. So I've not had the joy of using flared bars. I'd really love to try that. And I would love more real estate up front, because that is often an issue when I'm bikepacking. I've got the really narrow width and I have to squeeze everything between that. So yeah, I do look forward to having a go at having flared bars on my bike, but not yet at the moment.
I think it's a bit of a game changer. In fact, going back to road bikes, I just then feel like really tucked in and tiny, which is great for aerodynamic benefits, of course. But yeah, that sort of stability that you get going down over the rough stuff with flared bars is really great. Tom or Felix, have either of you tried those super wide bars that are like on trend in gravel at the moment? What are your thoughts on those?
I've not tried some. Our former colleague Matthew Loveridge one day presented me with some utterly ridiculous wide drop bars. PNWs, yeah. I can't remember how wide they were, but they were silly. And I said I'd put them on my bike. I was like, oh yeah, I'll do this, I'll do this. And then I was like, I'm not doing that.
I mean, at what point do you not just think, let me just have a standard sort of street bar, like a mountain bike?
Exactly, this is it. Yeah.
That's the debate, yeah.
I guess a wider bar will slow down your cornering. Mm-hmm. So I think going from maybe one extreme to another is, you know, it's going to have a massive impact on the handling of the bike. So I think if you are thinking about changing up, you know, maybe it's a good idea to try smaller steps.
That's very wise and sensible.
Also, aesthetically, those really wide bars look ridiculous, and I ain't putting that on my bike. And I've got one of those grit forks, one of those Lauf suspension forks on my bike, but I ain't putting silly wide bars on mine. You got to stop somewhere.
Nice. So that's position. I think a really good place to move on to next be some of the group set aspects. So gearing and braking.
Could I ask one more position question though before we do
move
on?
Yeah, go for it.
Seat position on the seat post is something that I don't consider very much on my gravel bike, but I consider all the time on my mountain bike, because I'm always striving for the steepest possible seat angle on my mountain bike, because I find on steep climbs it really helps with my position over the cranks. It makes it feel more efficient and more comfortable on prolonged steep climbs. But on my gravel bike, I've just sort of plonk it in the middle and stick with my 72.5 degree seat angle, I think. Is that something that you guys play around with, sort of changing the effective seat angle with your saddle position, or is that something you just ignore? Did it come to the bike fit?
Yeah, it's not something that came into my bike fit at all, or something that I've ever considered actually altering. It's sort of kept the same, really. Yeah.
Because with a saddle, you could pretty much get about a degree's alteration in your effective saddle angle from moving the saddle up and down the rails, but
I think that's a really interesting point, and something that I have struggled with a lot, you know, over the last couple of years testing gravel bikes. I always struggle with reach. And I think women in general have longer legs and shorter torsos. And also the new GRX shifters are just really quite long. So you put them onto a standard bar, and on almost every bike, even if it's a size small, I'm like really stretched out. So things like shortening the stem length and then sort of shuffling the saddle forwards a little bit on the seat post are sort of standard things for me for setup.
I agree with that. I mean, as my gravel, my gravel bike's a custom build. And the thing that I've always suffered from, I'm the average height of a male in the UK, which is about 5'10", 5'11". But my proportions are very long legs, short torso. So whenever I've gone for getting a bike, all the frame sizes sort of, they just, the top tube's too long and I'm constantly struggling, even with the shortest stem that I could get my hands on. That's always been a struggle. And that's the one benefit I found of getting the custom build, because I'd always try and get the shortest stem as possible to the point where it's getting a bit ridiculous. and yeah, that's the same as well with the hoods and that spacing in terms of reaching for your brakes and that sort of thing is always a challenge to get.
Yeah, right. And I think there's certain things you can do. Like you can get some bars that are really short across the tops. I'm sure there's a technical word for that.
The extension, is it?
The shorter reach bars, perhaps, which help to negate that a little bit. But I think it is quite interesting. I think Liv is the only bike brand that makes bikes with the geometry specifically for women rather than just altering finishing kit. And I think there could be, you know, a good argument for that in these sorts of cases where, you know, body geometry is significantly different and then the components that we use are a bit reachier than standard, for example. So quite a fascinating one. I'm interested to hear that you have similar issues in that respect. So moving on to gearing and braking and group sets, there are so many different options when it comes to gravel bikes. And I think definitely something that you'll see spec'd in many different combinations compared to if you're shopping for a road bike, for example, where it tends to be fairly standardized. I'm going to do a quick straw poll. One by or two by? Felix?
Two by. Recent convert.
Tom?
Ooh. One by and never, ever touching a foot mech again in my life.
Vera?
Two by.
Well, I'm one by as well. So that shows you, even between just the four of us, we're split dead down the middle. So, Tom, why do you love one by?
I love the simplicity of it. I hate front derailleurs. I like the way that the access group set on my bike shifts. And I'm running a mullet setup. So I have road bike shifters, force ones, paired through the magic of wireless encryption to a mountain bike SRAM XX1 rear mech and a mountain bike 10 to 52 tooth cassette. So I have a 520% gear range. And yes, I don't have those small steps between all my gears, but I've never found myself really wishing for that on a gravel ride. Now, on a road bike, two by all the way, but on a gravel bike, doesn't bother me.
Nice. Vera, what would your counter argument be for two by?
So two by, for me, it's those smaller changes in gearing. I just find that a lot more comfortable. I get really annoyed when I've got, you know, when my cadence of things has to change very much. So having those smaller graduations, for me, that's the winner on the two by. And also just the bigger range. And because for a gravel bike, you know, when I'm going on my adventures, it does involve quite a bit of road sometimes to get there or in sections. And it's much nicer to have that big range where I can get to the top speed, you know, quite easily as well, but also still be able to spin up those hills. So it's just the range that it gives me is amazing.
Yeah,
I do envy the simplicity of one bike. I do enjoy that off my mountain bike. But for a gravel bike, I'm quite happy with a two-by setup.
I think that just goes to show, like, two polar opposite answers. You know, there's no right or wrong answer. It just completely comes down to what your personal preference is, what kind of things that you're riding, what's important to you. So, yeah, it's definitely a tricky one. And, you know, we spoke in the previous episode about gearing and that a lot of these bikes out of the box are completely overgeared for, like, typical British gravel riding, for example. Almost every bike that I've ever had, I've ended up putting on a tiny chainring or going for a mullet setup, like Tom mentioned, just to be able to spin up the hills or if you want to put on bags and things and put a bit of extra weight on your bike. So it's definitely worth considering making some aftermarket changes if that would suit you better.
Absolutely. And I think for me, what I've had to do on the road bike I had previously and as well as this, my current gravel bike, is have one of those derailleur hanger extenders as well, because I need all the teeth I can get on the back. So I've got an 1142 on the back and a sort of 4832 on the front. And I've got one of those wolf tooth hanger extenders, and that works really well. And it's really just extended my gearing a lot more and being able to carry loads of bags and go backpacking and still be able to spin up hills.
I had a very funny experience a few years ago when we went to race the Catalunya Trail, which is a small ultra event. Well, I'm not sure if it would qualify as ultra. It's 330 kilometres up into the foothills of the Pyrenees from Girona. And there were a few of us that had travelled in from abroad, but mostly locals. And we were there with our gravel bikes loaded to the hilt with all of our camping gear and, you know, fairly, you know, standard one by sort of 40-tooth chain ring with a 11 to 42 on the back. And then all the locals had almost no gear on their bikes, mountain bikes with huge great cassettes and tiny chain rings. And we were like, oh, we've done this wrong. Turns out that everyone stayed in the refuges, which meant that you didn't have to take all the kit. And we saw why they were all on mountain bikes, because it wasn't hugely technical, the riding, but obviously being in the foothills of the Pyrenees, it was incredibly steep. So yeah, I think the kind of riding that we talk about with about gravel riding and ultra distance as well, like, you don't always have to ride a gravel bike just because it's off-road terrain. You know, XC bikes, rigid mountain bikes also come in really, really handy and quite often are geared much better to these sorts of events.
Absolutely.
So hydraulic disc brakes are almost universal, I'd say, in most gravel bikes. Towards the budget end, you might find quite a few cable-operated mechanical disc brakes. Have any of you tried those, or do you have a preference for hydraulic disc brakes? Felix, have you ever tried cable discs?
Yeah, so I've got good experience because Grinduro that I mentioned earlier, I did that on some cable-operated disc brakes. And yeah, like, there were some quite steep technical trails. And with the disc brakes, I was really struggling to kind of even squeeze hard enough to kind of slow down. You know, it's the obvious kind of differences between hydraulic and a cable operated disc. That's the big one. But when you're doing anything technical, it's so much more important to be able to kind of get the right braking compared to if you're riding on the road. It's not quite as, I guess the differences aren't quite as stark. But I then changed bikes for Dirty Reaver, and I had GRX, the 11 speed version. Hydraulic disc brakes there was just, I was just so happy going down the first descent, and I was no longer kind of cramping up in my hands as I was coming into it. If anything, it was like, well, okay, yeah, dial back that a little bit. Don't want to lock up, go over the bars. If you, especially if you're kind of new to it, I suppose, having the confidence in braking is obviously going to be really important, because you want to be able to slow down when you want to.
Definitely. And I suppose there are some advantages of cable in that it's like super easy to change if you're in the middle of nowhere and you've got a spare cable, for example, rather than trying to bleed hydraulic brakes, etc. And obviously a little bit cheaper. But I think the more people I speak to, the more recommend hydraulic disc brakes as just being that much more powerful.
Yeah, I would also add that, yeah, going completely the opposite way, if you've got an old pair of hydraulic brakes that have done like maybe a couple of winters and maybe they're getting a little bit old and they haven't bled, I've certainly found that you start getting a few little issues with them, maybe contaminated pads or rotors. Maybe they need a bit of a bleed and maybe the pistons are a bit sticky, and then you've suddenly got a pretty bad pair of brakes. So I think there's another argument there be prepared to maybe service them a bit more regularly than you would with a cable operated disc. That's what I found anyway. So while they're out of the box, they might feel really, really good. I think they do definitely require a little bit more maintenance to keep them that way.
Yep, definitely. Okay, so I'm going to go for another quick straw poll. 650B or 700C? Tom?
Proper big 700C wheels. So faster.
I thought you were going to say 29er then. Vera?
700 as well.
And Felix?
700.
Whoa, we've got a full house of 700. That's really interesting. I used to be quite anti 650B, to be honest. When I first started gravel riding, I was very lucky to have a bike that had clearance for 45 mil tyres, which was quite unheard of quite a few years ago. And a lot of bikes are now moving towards more generous tyre clearances. And I just thought that 650B wheels were for people who had bikes that didn't have the tyre clearance, i.e. they should have been designed better in the first place to accept better tyres, bigger tyres. And they certainly have their place. Like shorter riders, you can get much better geometry, much more proportional to the frame size. But it's very interesting that we've got a full house of 700C. Any particular reason?
I mean, for me, it's just what I sort of was set up with, didn't really know much about it at the time. But also the only time I ever heard of 650B was this really lovely short lady in my club. She must be like 5 foot. And that's the only person that ever heard use 650B. So for me, it was associated with smaller people because I wasn't a small person. I was like, oh, well, I have to go for the 700 option. But obviously I understand there's, you know, there's different differences between them and stuff. But yeah, I've just stuck to 700 because it just is, I think, more common, and just haven't had any issues with that. So yeah.
Tom, you've never been tempted?
No. I think, as I said earlier, I quite like an aggressive, like racy gravel bike. So I've always stuck with maybe slightly narrower, well, not super wide tyres. And I sort of always saw those big bulbous, you know, like 2-inch wide tyres on a 650B bike as a something good for, like, if you want to trundle along and enjoy the view, but that's not really been my bag. But I have to admit that my views on wide tyres has been challenged recently. I went on the launch of the Lauf Segler and rode that bike, which is still an aggressive-ish race gravel bike, but you can fit 2-inch or 2.2-inch tyres in there. And I rode that on a ride there with, 2.2-inch Maxxis Icon, effectively mountain bike tyres. And it didn't feel as sluggish as I imagined it might have done. So while I will stick to the bigger wheels, because I think from a mountain bike side of things, they are faster and I'm tall enough that I don't have to worry about bum clearance. Yeah, maybe my views were a little bit prejudiced in the past. You can be fast on wide tyres.
Don't knock it till you've tried it.
Exactly that, yeah.
Yeah, I guess the reason why I'd go for 700C, purely practical reason of being able to change tyres over a single wheel set. I mean, gravel wheel sets these days are pretty, you know, interchangeable between road and you know, mixed surface, whatever you want, really. So being able to just quickly change a tyre from and make your bike more roadworthy, and then maybe on the weekend you want to do a big gravel ride, great, I'll just switch to some wider tyres. That is like, yeah, that is practically speaking really, really cool to have.
Nice. And you've been on the Cannondale signups, haven't you, for your long-termer? Is that something that you switch between wheel sets on?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I tend to ride with a dynamo wheel, actually. I'm quite limited in terms of tyre clearance because in the winter I've got mudguards. And if you've got mudguards and you do any kind of off-roading, any kind of gravel riding, you'll know that you just get
mud riding
up super
yeah
quick. Yeah. We've all been there, I think.
Yeah.
But in summer I will actually ride on the road with 32 mil tyres, which some people might go, whoa, what are you doing that for?
That sounds really comfy.
It's really comfy, yeah. Yeah. And it's if you gravel bikes tend to sometimes be a bit more comfy than road bikes, so the combination is really nice to have, particularly for longer distance. Obviously, if you're racing, maybe that's not quite what you want, but for any kind of longer distance stuff, it's comfort for me.
Definitely. So on my personal gravel bike at home, I have two wheel sets. I'm very lucky to have two 700C wheel sets that are both, I think, optimized for gravel, but perfectly fine for road. They have 21 mil internals. And I just have a set of slicks on one of them that measure up at about 32 mil. And some knobblies on the others. And that's just really great because you can switch between the two really easily and you don't have to, you know, jiggle your gearing or anything like that. And obviously it takes up a lot less space in the garage or if you've, you know, limited on space at home. So that's a handy one.
Oh, I was just going to add on that. So I go the budget version of that, which is why I haven't gone tubeless on any of my bikes, is because I just changed the actual tyre. So I use the same rims and everything, same wheel. But I'm constantly swapping between 28 mil wide tyres and 45 gravel. from the week to the weekend. So in the week, if I'm doing like riding around a track, I go a lot thinner and I just change that. And then Friday, swap them up for gravel tires and go ride gravel. So I'd love
incredible.
To have
do you have super
set,
strong thumbs?
I was going to say you must have strong thumbs.
Yeah. Well, or arthritis at this moment, but I don't know which. But it's a lot of work, constantly changing between the two. But it means my ability to now change punctures real quick has massively improved. But it's also a lot more space saving just to have the tires to change.
Nice. So on the subject of tires, do we have any particular recommendations? What are you using at the moment, Vera?
Oh, so I'm using some Hutchinson Toreg gravel tires. They're tubeless ready, but as I said, I just run tubes in them because I'm constantly changing. But they're really good for dry gravel. Anything muddy, yeah, they're not great, but for Wales gravel is predominantly dry most of the time. Yeah, I wouldn't take them to Bristol, but yeah, they handle pretty well. So yeah, and pretty puncture resistant as well. Haven't had a single puncture on them. Touch wood.
Excellent. How about yourself, Tom? What are you using at the moment?
I've currently got a Maxxis Rambler on the front and a Bontrager GR2 on the back. So the front is a 45C, which fits nicely, and on the back is a 40C. My frame has a 45C max clearance, but obviously living in the Southwest, mud is a constant companion. So I've been running 40s, but I am about to fit a second 45C Rambler on the back because I'm going somewhere, hopefully, well, fingers crossed, drier. If it isn't drier, I'm going to be a very unhappy young man. there's a reason I'm leaving the UK for 6 weeks. Yeah, so yeah, 45-45 will be the plan with the Ramblers. And I quite like the Rambler tyre. Like, it rolls pretty nicely on tarmac and on hard surfaces, but has got just enough bite to dig through the mud if it does get a bit softer.
And interesting what you say there. I think I come at it from a total roadie perspective in that you just get a pair of tyres of whatever it is and be done with it. But you've gone for different treads or different brands.
Yeah, but I mean, only because like my 40C Rambler was like knackered. And Jez at Trek's great and he sent me some of his tyres quicker than Maxxis could send me some.
Yeah. Brilliant. But there definitely is something to be said, I think, for switching up because you don't need the same qualities on the front as you do the rear necessarily.
Yeah, no, totally. Certainly on a mountain bike, I would never, very rarely at least, run matching tyres front and back. From like an aesthetic point of view, I might run the same brand front and back, and it would be Maxxis front and back most likely. But I would rarely, yeah, your tyres do different things. On the front, you want steering control predominantly, and on the back, you want braking control, and the two tyres do different things.
So is it normally wider on the front then?
Yeah, certainly. Most of the time, I would run them fairly similar, within sort of 0.5 of a 2 point. I'd run like a 2.5 on the front and a 2.4 on the back, maybe on a mountain bike quite often. And on gravel, I mean, if I could run wider tyres on my True Grit, I would run wider. I just been riding some 50C Ramblers. And I think that's probably, for me, like on gravel, the best compromise of size and weight and rolling resistance and feel. But yeah, I'd go slightly wider on the front, personally.
Nice. How about you, Felix? What are you running at the moment on your gravel bikes?
So I got WTV Nano tyres.
Oh, the old faithful.
Yeah, they've been around for a while, actually, haven't they? Yeah, why would you change it?
God bless the Nano.
Yeah, I've almost like there is something to say in what you're used to, like the predictability of a tyre, and changing up isn't always the best thing to do. So yeah, that's what I roll. But we've done a big old tyre test, gravel tyre test at Bike Radar. So you can always watch the video on that, because we've got a great rundown of loads of different tyres that have been tested.
Excellent.
What's your tyre of choice, Catherine? What are you? You're a bit of a bigwig in the world of gravel tyres.
I have been testing a lot of gravel tyres over the last few months. Difficult to pick out any particular one. I've been really impressed by TerraVale's ease of setup. I've been able to set up all of them with a track pump rather than a pressurised gas or, you know, extra assistance, which is a big bonus. The WTB Nano, it's got this little place in my heart because we've been together for a long time, and it's always a good, you know, go-to. And also some of the Vittoria tyres. I think with Vittoria, you have to be quite careful because you remember that they were developed initially for cyclocross, which is essentially riding through mud and grass. So the puncture resistance in their standard tyres isn't what you might want for you know, gravel and quite spiky rocks and things. But they do offer a carcass that's reinforced, which is much better. Their Tirreno Dry is a really interesting tyre that's like almost slick down the middle with a very, very low profile sort of honeycomb structure and then much more aggressive knobs on the edge where you really want it for cornering. So I really enjoyed that one in particular. Just a shame that I had it in the thinner version and I ripped a sidewall on the first ride. So yeah, definitely go for the reinforced carcass. And speaking of tearing sidewalls, I know that Tom Marvin will have some opinions on this because I think we've discussed it in the office before. Tire inserts are becoming more and more popular in the mountain biking world. Do they work for gravel?
Well, I'm hoping to find out as it happens. I haven't really used inserts hugely on the mountain bikes. I've always gone for, so I guess to those who aren't sort of sure what we're talking about. So a tire insert is a ring of foam usually that goes inside the tire. Some of them wrap really tightly around the rim and you sort of push the tire bead underneath them and in, and it sort of really locks the tire onto the rim. And some of them kind of float within the tire void. And they have two sort of main functions. Although not all of them do everything, but the two functions really are to protect against pinch punctures. So they, when your tire hits like a square edge, it sort of squashes itself down, and a pinch is when the thing that you're bumping over and the rim pierce the sidewalls of the tires. And so having a bit of high density foam that sort of sits between those two bits of tire carcass that would pinch together and puncture protects from pinch punctures. The other function of a tire insert, which as I say not all of them are there to do, is to offer extra tire stability. So when you corner with a low pressure, the tire rolls on the rim, and having a piece of foam in there that's tightly wrapped around the rim and pushes against the sidewall prevents the tire from rolling side to side. And some people claim that it improves the feel of the tire, it improves cornering traction, you can run lower pressures with less chance of rolling the tire off the rim. So in the mountain bike side of things, they're fairly well established. They're very Marmite. We've colleagues here who swear by them and colleagues here who swear at them. I haven't really used them very much because I am mechanically incompetent and generally speaking,
I think we've learned this from your tubeless setup woes.
Yes. I'm not a fan of adding complication. However, and so thus far on gravel bikes, I haven't used them much. I have been on rides with people who have punctured torn sidewalls and using a cush core setup and then being able to ride home 20 or 30 kilometres just on using the foam and the tyre with no air in. And that is obviously a massive benefit of them, is that it's a get home sort of safe system. But I have just received this morning in the post Rimpact's tyre inserts for, it's actually for their cross tyres and wheels, so 35 to 45 C widths, and they have a gravel insert coming. The reason why I've done that is because obviously, as you sort of mentioned, I'm going bike packing. I don't like punctures. And so the thought of having some extra puncture protection, especially for the rear wheel, for me, was really interesting. I did chat to Simon Bromley and Warren Roster about inserts a few weeks ago in the office. My worry, kind of, I'd ridden a bike with inserts and also with a set of tyres that I'd not ridden before, and it felt horrible. Like, it dragged and it felt really slow and painful. And I was like, God, so that put me right off. Simon is more scientifically or technically minded than I, and he's done some research, and apparently they can cost maybe a watt or two, so that is relatively meagre, and so I think it was just the tyres that my friend was running on his gravel bike were just terrible tyres that I would never want to put on my bike. So yeah, I've got some inserts which I'm going to put in mostly at the rear to protect against punctures.
So how are we going to find out how they fare
in approximately 14 weeks' time when I come back into the office, I'll tell you if I had any punctures.
I'll be checking out your stories,
yeah,
actually.
There'll be stories as well. There will be stories. Yeah.
There we go.
That's my uninformed take on the tyre insert. Big in mountain biking, I think potential in gravel riding if you're someone who is looking for those qualities.
Nice. Well, we'll keep our eyes peeled to hear how you... Hang on, that doesn't make any sense. Keep our eyes peeled. Well, we'll wait to hear from you how you get on with those. But that's definitely an interesting thing that I think we could be seeing a little bit more of in the gravel world in coming years.
I think so. I think they're a really interesting type of product. And I think there's a lot we could talk. I mean, I could talk for a long time about this sort of thing. And I don't think our listeners really want to listen to me rabbit on about it all. But there's lots of pros and cons, and you know, some people will find the work really well for them. Other people may think it's a waste of 80 quid.
So drop a post in Suspension for gravel bikes. We've obviously had a major launch this year with SRAM bringing out their Explore Axis with the RockShox Rudy fork up front and then the Reverb Explore Axis drop a post. Is this something that anybody's tried? Any sort of short travel options on gravel bikes? What are your thoughts on adding suspension to what's otherwise a rigid bike?
Get a mountain bike.
I've had some experience.
Actually, no, that's not necessarily my opinion. It's, yeah. But a lot of people have that opinion.
I have some experience with this, I guess. So I've used the Lauf fork extensively for years. And I have used telescopic gravel suspension forks. So obviously there is the Rudy. Fox has just launched the 32 taper cast, I think they've called it. And obviously a lot of big noise about these two big brands bringing out their gravel forks, but there have been many others before these. It's just that they either weren't marketed very well or people didn't care about them because they weren't RockShox and Fox. But anyway, that's my little rant out of the way. I think they're interesting. I think they certainly have a place for the right person. I think they may be potentially easy to misunderstand what they are good and not good at. And I think each of them has their own unique performance attributes. So I guess you could split them into, split forks into, I reckon, four camps. You've got your rigid fork, the classic one where, you know, much like a road bike fork where it's a rigid fork. You'd have the Lauf, which is a leaf sprung fork. So you're using glass fiber leaf springs to connect these two dog links that link to the front legs of the fork with a friction-free, undamped 30 mil of travel. You have telescopic forks, which are borrowing a lot of tech from mountain bike forks. So that's, you know, your Fox 32 taper cast, that's your RockShox Rudy, MRP have one, various other iterations out there, obviously Lefty. And then there's the specialized Future Shock, which mounts a suspension above the head tube and suspends the handlebars, but not the bike. This is probably another thing that I could probably rabbit on a long time about with various opinions. But yeah, I think they're all interesting, and I think you can't tarnish them all with, you can't paint them all with the same brush. I think they do different things depending on the design of what you've gone for.
So run us through the Lauf. You've been using that fork for a few years now. What is it that does for you that makes you think it's worthwhile?
Okay, so the Lauf fork is, I'll say what it's good at and I'll say what it's not good at. It's very good at tuning out super high frequency, low amplitude buzz. So when you're riding along, like a classic gravel road, it just smooths everything out because there's no friction, okay? And that just means that it's super reactive to little bumps and everything. Where it's not so good at is if you, because it's not damped, so damping is the control of the spring's movement. So effectively, the Lauf fork is just like a classic spring you'd get out of your ballpoint pen, you know, just like twang, you know, twangs up and down. A damping would stop that twang in its path and slow it down. And that's what a mountain bike fork, they all rely on those. And that's why the Lauf mountain bike fork wasn't very good. But a telescopic fork has oil dampers in there, which slow it down and give you a bit more control over the stroke of the fork. The issue with those is that they have seals, and seals introduces friction. And on super high frequency, low amplitude buzz, friction is inevitably going to impact on how well the fork copes with those. It might feel great when it's boxed fresh, but over time it's going to need a bit more maintenance to look after it. However, because it's got damping, and the structure of those telescopic forks means they're a little bit stiffer than the lough fork, which can twist and twang a little bit in the wrong situations. And that damping does mean you have a bit more control over it. You're also going to have a lockout on there. So if you are on the road and you want something absolutely solid, you can have that. And then if you look at the Future Shock, the forks that sort of sit underneath the head tube suspend the bike. So the frame itself moves less when you hit a bump. And that, in theory, means it's faster. As far as I can tell, it should be a faster thing. The Future Shock suspends the handlebar, so while it improves the comfort, it doesn't stop the bike from oscillating over those bumps.
It's very fascinating. I'm like nerding out right now. I'm just sat here like, oh Tom, I can listen to you talk forever. I haven't used any of this stuff, but like it just takes me back to my mechanical engineering degree, just hearing all these springs.
Oh God,
and
you're probably way more qualified than I am. I'm gonna
this is really
Jack,
good amplitudes
Jack
and
White
frequencies.
This bit
I'm
of the podcast.
Like having a whale of a time just listening to you right now.
I think it's really interesting. It's, you know, like on a mountain bike, there's very few people who ride mountain bikes now without suspension, because it's so proven that it makes you faster, it makes you more comfortable, and it reduces fatigue. And I get like the classic, the traditionalist view of, you know, if it's got suspension, just ride a mountain bike. But I do think they're different, and I think they do different things, and they're there for a different reason. So yeah, each has their pluses and minuses.
Absolutely. I think I might be stuck in the dark ages, because I do really enjoy a rigid bike, but I think there's so much that can be done by altering your tire pressures and just tweaking that in terms of giving you more comfort, that obviously might cost you much less or nothing compared to forking out. If it's like, I know Redshift do a stem that has an elastomer, changeable elastomer in it, so you get a little bit of vibration absorption up front, or then moving on to the sort of more mountain bike analogous suspension that's been around for a little while and sort of heightened in popularity recently. I think this is probably somewhere where we'll see a bit more growth in gravel over the next few years. And there's quite a few brands that are now building suspension into their bikes, like the BMC, for example. I think something like 20 mil on the rear. And I think we'll probably see a little bit more of that for riders looking for a little bit more comfort. But I don't think it's quite been proven yet just whether these suspension systems do make them faster or not.
I would argue that they almost, if you exclude pan flat or pan smooth mid-American, like basically tarmac roads that happen to be a bit dusty, I'd put money on suspended bikes being faster, so long as it's suspended in the right way. Yeah. And, you know, like, take the, you know, the Lauf True Grit and the Segler, they are race bikes, and they're not designed for bike packing. They're not designed to be like bimbling around the countryside. They're designed to be, you know, arse up, head down race bikes, and they're smoother. And thus it means you can pedal better. You're more comfortable and you can pedal longer. And I would generally put money on them being faster.
I'm also in the camp that of, Excuse me. I'd also say that I think in the future we're going to see way more thought being put into the rear part of the bike, in the comfort that you can get from the rear part, because I think it's, like you said, there's quite a few options for suspending the front part of the bike. Like, you know, you could go down the route of a stem, like the Redshift stem, or if you're lucky enough, you could get suspension aftermarket. But I think in terms of sort of frame design, I think we're going to see that change quite dramatically over the next few years, because I think that's just, it's not something that you can upgrade particularly easily. Obviously you can get as wide a tire as you can fit in your frame, but you're pretty much limited to what the kind of design and the construction and the materials of what the frame is made out of. So yeah, when you've experienced sort of that washboard gravel and you're hitting that at speed, over time it wears you right down. And I've no doubt that you'd be faster because you're less fatigued if you had that sort of comfort built in.
I was wondering, how much of a difference do seat posts and, you know, this, you know, sort of suspension seat posts and things like that, how much difference does that make to comfort compared to, frame and other parts?
It's a really good question, actually. And I, I kind of missed that out there, but yeah, suspension seat posts are another upgrade that you can make to help that rear suspension.
I think you've got to be careful with a suspended seat post because they, if they have like a parallelogram design where, you know, they offer genuine like travel, you're changing the dynamics of the distance between the cranks and where you're sat, and so that will have an impact. I run a Canyon VCLS 2 seat post on my Lauf, which is like a two-piece seat post that has a bit of more fore back flex, again just to take the buzz out. It doesn't have like lots of vertical travel, but it certainly helps reduce buzz. And as Felix alluded to, you know, there are numerous bikes coming out now with those slightly flexier or vertically compliant back ends, whether it's the Segler or the Topstone or the URS or various other ones. And I think there is an element of additional comfort from there, which will impact on sort of fatigue and thus speed. I don't think anyone's sort of suspecting that. Remember the Niner full suspension gravel bike that came out Eurobike about 4 or 5 years ago? Yeah. Looked utterly terrible. I don't think we're going to see bikes like that coming, but I think we will see a lot more bikes coming with compliance, like genuine compliance built into frames.
Definitely. And going back to what you were saying about the future shock there on Specialized and how, you know, suspension is going to be some of the smoothest and fastest. We have seen a whole raft of pro wins on the Specialized Diverge across the American gravel scene, with riders such as Alison Tetrick and Lawrence Ten Dam doing exceptionally well on some of those bikes. So whether you agree that they're effective or not, you know, they're really racking up quite a number of wins.
Don't get me wrong. I don't think they're ineffective. Mm. I think also Specialized can get some good athletes on their bikes. I think I can't give you a source sadly, but the science of suspending the bike over the handlebars is fairly, I'd say it's fairly robust. If the bike is not pitching backwards and forwards over something, it is going to run smoother, and a telescopic fork or a, you know, a fork based suspension will do that more than a stem based one. You will obviously get the comfort or a lot of the comfort benefits from a stem or from a future shock, but I would still suggest back-to-back-to-back, properly suspended frame will be better, personally.
Definitely somewhere where we're going to see...
I mean, I ain't Lawrence Ten Dam. and he can beat me on anything, I'm sure. Put him on my mum's shopper bike and he'd beat me.
Brilliant. So I think we should wrap up with some setup tips specifically for those who are looking at loading up with bags and travelling off, as Tom is about to do, and as I'm sure we've all got some exciting plans to do this summer. Are there any particular modifications that you can make to your bike or things that you've tried, Vera, to make your gravel bike more bikepacking friendly?
Well, I mean, when getting it made or when I was getting my custom bike built, I just asked for as many mounting points as possible, really. And that's, you know, everywhere across the bike. I've got like four bosses on each fork and the down tube and everything. And it's just maximizing where you can put bottle holders and be able to put tools and that sort of thing. Really helpful. My setup is pretty standard. So yeah, if I'm going sort of bike packing, I've got a half frame bag. I've got bottle cages, which are side entry. Is that what you call them? But it just makes it easier just reaching for stuff. And that I found that one of the biggest helps because I couldn't get a frame bag and a bottle that I'm pulling up the top at the same time. I know it's one of those minor things. I still just use a normal type saddle bag. I haven't tried one of those tail fin arrangements, but I do also have the option for a pannier if I'm going for a more relaxed ride. But yeah, struggling to think what else I'd have on there really. But yeah.
Nice. How about you, Tom? What have you got planned for your setup for your big trip? Have you got that far yet?
I have just sent an email to someone about getting hold of some bits. I've been very lucky to have been lent a tail fin setup for the bike, which would be great. So I've got a tail fin on the back with two of the 10 litre bags to go on the side. After this, I'm going to go and grab some bags for the fork as well, and a something else that they've asked me not really to talk about at the moment. And I will have a frame bag as well. I mean, I'm going for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
I intend to be comfortable for 6 weeks.
And if you're leaving the UK, that's a lot of tea bags.
That's a lot of, need a lot of tea bags.
Where are you off to, Tom? Sorry if I
don't mind. I'm going to go and, I'm not doing the whole route, but I'm going to go and ride a portion of the European Divide. So the European Divide goes from Portugal to the north of Norway. And I am flying to Barcelona in 3 weeks' time. And I'm going to head north, hopefully somewhere in northern Germany or Denmark, somewhere like that. So that's the plan. I've got tail fin largely set up, an Apadura frame bag as well, just to make sure I've got everything carried with plenty of food. And like you said, like side loading bottle cages is going to be really handy because of the frame bag. My one little bit of luxury, other than a Kindle, is I have bought myself a Helinox camping chair. So
wow.
I have a very comfortable 500-gram camping chair, and I justified it to myself because I basically bankrupted myself on lightweight sleeping equipment. So my mat and my bag and my pillow weighs under a kilo combined. So I was like, I'm gonna have a camping chair. So yeah,
just to offset that lightweight kit.
That's the thing. I figured if I was gonna go for like a week, then I would go like super, super, super light. But if I'm going to go for 6 weeks, I want to sit down and not on the floor for 6 weeks.
Fair enough. How about you, Felix?
There we go.
When you've been on some of your longer travels, are there any specific changes that you've made to your bike setup to accommodate for that?
Yeah, a couple. Couple of things. I think the easy one and the kind of nice one for me is bar tape. Quite often you get a standard kind of thin-ish bar tape on a bike that comes stock. So yeah, get a nice squishy bar tape, and then getting the right, and that's a dodgy one to do just before a trip, but saddle, obviously, saddle comfort's major thing. Yeah, and so hard for, you know, to give any recommendations out, but I think the width of your saddle is obviously one of the things that you can actually check yourself, and you know, make sure that the saddle that you wear, you've actually got at the minute, is not too narrow or too wide for you. And you can actually do that quite easily with a piece of tinfoil on a step and do some measurements. I think there's a Bike Radar article that helps you do that. I'd say your contact points are obviously really important. And then your footwear as well. Maybe this isn't to do with the bike, but I suppose you're making that decision whether or not you're going to go flats or SPD pedals that you'd use on a mountain bike or gravel bike, or you want to go full road. If you may be hardly doing any gravel on your route, then you might want your trusty road shoes. I'd say don't be afraid to go for flats if you're not used to clipping in. You know, you don't want the pressure of that, especially if you're going for like a longer distance thing. And you're not all about speed. Then being able to just hop off your bike into a shop without slipping over on a supermarket floor.
We've all been there.
I think there's things like that can just make it just a little bit more enjoyable.
Brilliant. Well, I think that wraps up many different aspects of gravel bike setup. Thank you very much, Vera, Tom and Felix, for joining us today, and best of luck in all of your upcoming challenges and adventures. I hope there's been plenty of gems in there for you today, but if you'd like even more about gravel bike setup, then of course there's a comprehensive guide on bikeradar.com, which we'll link to in the show notes. Make sure you subscribe to the Bike Radar podcast, and while we are there, we'd really appreciate a 5-star review. Stay tuned for loads more of Where This Came From too, with our top tips for planning a dreamy gravel ride coming up next week.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends, or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.